Revelation chapter 7. I am going to be giving you a number of handouts at the end of this today's class, or to end the class, that will in a visual way recapitulate some of what I'm going to be sharing with you today. But I want to cover a few things in a summary way first. And as we have seen in the coverage of the six seals in chapter 6, the first six seals of the seven lay out for us in dramatic fashion the prelude to what will be the seventh seal. And the first four seals show, using very terrible imagery, the wrath and cursing of God that would pour out upon Israel upon the appointed time of judgment. And in the fifth of the six seals that we have already looked at, those faithful prophets and saints of the older covenant who suffered martyrdom at the hands of the leaders of Israel in their day, along with their newer covenant brothers and sisters who have suffered the same fate in the new covenant era, in this time period between the ascension of Jesus and the coming day of tribulation and judgment that would end up being around AD 70. We have this imagery in the fifth seal of these martyrs crying out to heaven for vengeance. And the sixth seal portrays the soon coming great tribulation as spoken beforehand by the prophet Daniel and by Jesus himself in Matthew 24, as we've already had occasion to consider. But now, before the opening of the seventh seal, the author of Revelation experiences two visions that convey a consoling message of assurance of the deliverance and safety of God's people in the midst of the tribulation that was coming upon the land. And the first vision is recorded in verses 1 through 8 of Revelation 7, and the second is in verses 9 through 17 of Revelation 7. So look with me at Revelation 7, verses 1 through 8. And I'll read it from the New King James Version. After these things, now let me stop right there. You notice I have put on the board, after this or after these things does not imply chronological order. Just because of the fact that this has been set down into writing and put with verses and chapters, our minds sort of automatically view this as this thing happening one right after the other in chronological order. That's not what's going on here. We're not given a time frame when he says after these things or after this. I'll have more to say about that in just a moment. But anyway, he says, after these things, I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding the four winds of the earth, that the wind should not blow on the earth, on the sea, or on any tree. And I saw another angel ascending from the east, having the seal of the living God. And he cried with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was granted to harm the earth and the sea, saying, do not harm the earth, the sea, or the trees till we have sealed the servants of our God on their foreheads. And I heard the number of those who were sealed. 144,000 of all the tribes of the children of Israel were sealed. And then he lists the tribes there in verses 1 through 8. I'll have more to say about that listing in just a moment. But I want to go back and underline what I just said about the after this or after those things. As I said, it's not meant to imply a chronological unfolding of an event with an historical time frame. Rather, it functions to speak of how these events were unfolding within the dynamic vision that the author of Revelation, the Apocalypse, was experiencing at the time. And among the ancient Near Eastern peoples, getting now to the symbolism of what he's seen in this first cycle of the visions, the four winds are representative of the four points of the compass: north, south, east, and west. And here the author sees a vision of angelic beings at the extremities of these compass points holding back the winds. And since the location of the upheaval and And the catastrophe has already been located for us and in our study in the land of Israel, and more specifically, that larger metropolitan area of Jerusalem. There's no warrant for abandoning that foundation to read these words in the present verses as somehow applying a cosmic or universal scale of events. We're still talking about the unfolding of God's wrath on the nation of Israel in that time and in that place. The reality is, for the first century Christian, for the first century person, be he Christian or not, let me say that again. For the first century Jew, be he Christian or not, Jerusalem and Israel were the center of the world. And to his mind, the fate of that place, the fate of Israel and Jerusalem, in a larger sense, in a spiritual sense, determines the fate of the entire universe. Next, the vision indicates the rising of another angel who bears the seal of God. And let me just read that to you again, and then I want you to, well, go ahead and turn to Ezekiel. I've got the passage written on the board. Turn to Ezekiel chapter 9, verses 4 through 6. Ezekiel chapter 9, verses 4 through 6. And I'll wait till you're there, because I want to read this passage again from Revelation, and you can see something of what's going on here, and how, once again, the Old Testament helps us understand the context, and it directs us right back to the land of Israel and to the city of Jerusalem and the people who were living at that time and in that day. It says here, then I saw, and this is Revelation chapter 7, verse 2, you stay there with Ezekiel 9, then I saw another angel ascending from the east, having the seal of the living God, and he cried out with a loud voice to the four angels whom it was granted to harm the earth and the sea, do not harm the earth, the sea, or the trees, till we have sealed the servants of our God on their foreheads. Now look at Ezekiel 9, 4 to 6. And the Lord said to him, pass through the city, through Jerusalem, notice Jerusalem, and put a mark on the foreheads of the men who sigh and groan over all the abominations that are committed. Ezekiel is addressing the abomination and apostasy of Israel in that day and the judgment that was coming upon Jerusalem. Put a seal, a mark on their foreheads. Verse 5, and to the others he said in my hearing, pass through the city after him and strike. Your eye shall not spare, and you shall show no pity. Kill old men outright, young men and maidens, little children and women, but touch no one on whom is the mark, and begins at my sanctuary. So they began with the elders who were there before the house. All right, turn back to Revelation 7. Now here, the sealing, this idea is introduced, and it's used in the context of a faithful remnant, both, I'm going to argue, in Revelation 7, but also especially in Ezekiel 9, a faithful remnant who have not stained themselves with the moral evil and apostasy of the masses and the leaders of Israel in that time in which Ezekiel was writing. And it's to be noted that death and destruction upon Jerusalem was a sign of God's covenant wrath in that day. And in these verses in chapter 7 of the Apocalypse, the reader, we're not told the nature of the seal that the angel has, but it becomes clear in later chapters. Now you can find, I've got some old commentaries on Revelation. You might find some even in some of the newer ones, but the footnotes or the commentary will tell you that the seal is the sign of the cross. They'll have the sign of the cross on their foreheads. Well, it doesn't say that. That's some fanciful reading into it. I guess it wouldn't be altogether out of the contrary, but or out of the ordinary that something like that might happen. But if we're going with what the text says, it doesn't say anything about a sign of a cross on the forehead. We're not told in chapter 7 the nature of the seal that the angel has, but it will become clear in later chapters what the seal is, especially in chapter 14, that the seal is the name of the Lamb of God, or God the Father, variously. And so then the rising of this angel out of the east warns the other angels of death and destruction not to do any harm on the land until the faithful remnants of the followers of the Messiah have come into the covenant relationship. They are to be delivered from the coming wrath, even as those who bore the mark described in Ezekiel 9 were delivered from the wrath that God was bringing at that time. And now we come to the famous figure of 144,000. Now, as we all know, that figure represents only those who will be saved who had the privilege of being born in the state of South Carolina. I mean, that's the absurdity that some people take this, and I think, who do we most associate with the 144,000? The Jehovah's Witnesses. Now, they have sort of made famous this number and associated it with their teachings that only the 144,000 Jehovah's Witnesses will be saved in the coming tribulation or whatever it is that they say. And apart from the Jehovah's Witnesses, there's still a lot of disagreement, even among Orthodox Christians, about what this number represents. But before going any further, look over to Revelation 14, and I want you to see the reference there, because this figure of 144,000 is not found anywhere else in either late Jewish or early Christian literature. It's only found here in the Apocalypse. In Revelation 14, verses 1 through 5, we read, "Then I looked, and behold, a lamb standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having his father's name written on their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven, like the voice of many waters, and like the voice of loud thunder. And I heard the sound of harpists playing their harps. They sang, as it were, a new song before the throne, before the four living creatures and the elders, and no one could learn the song except the 144,000 who were redeemed from the earth. These are the ones who were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These were redeemed from among men, being first fruits to God and to the Lamb, and in their mouth was found no deceit, for they are without fault before the throne of God." Now, turn back to Revelation 7. These are the only two places that we have where this number is quoted and referenced, either in the Bible or any other kind of religious literature of that day that we know of. And because of these limitations, we have to assume that the figure refers to the same groups of people in both places, chapter 7 and chapter 14. Now, among the more orthodox explanations for the number, these explanations have ranged from the number signifying the faithful remnant of Israel to Jewish Christians to mainly Gentile Christians. Now, the number itself, as I've written on the board, is obviously consists of multiples of 12, 12,000, 12 times 12,000, or 12 times 12 times 1,000, and the numbers have obvious symbolic meaning. 12 tribes of Israel, 12 apostles, multiplied by the token number of wholeness or completeness, which is 1,000, and that produces a figure that is meant to convey the idea of completeness, the idea of totality, of all those chosen to be in covenant with God through the Messiah. They represent the true Israel. Israel as it was originally intended by God to be. A nation united, a nation complete, whole, and in harmony with her Lord. That's what this figure represents. The true Israel of God in that time and in that place. And now, in addition to the symbolic number being much debated, there's another point here that's a point of some controversy with some researchers. If you look down at that list again of the tribes of Israel that are listed there, there's one tribe that's missing. Does anybody know what it is without looking at your New Geneva Study Bible study notes? The tribe of Dan. Now, that's been another source of some debate as to why the tribe of Dan is left off the list of the tribes of Israel. There have been all kinds of speculations. There have been some speculations that the Antichrist was to arise out of the tribe of Dan. And there have been other speculations. Well, the simplest and most likely explanation, well, do tell me, What would be the simplest and most likely explanation as to why the tribe of Dan was left out? That's right. It would make 13. That's probably the reason it was not included. Now, in the final segment of the verses of this chapter, a second vision comes to the author, and like the other, it begins with the words that must not be taken as a statement of literal chronological order. Look with me at chapter 7, verse 9. After these things, I looked, and behold, a great multitude, which no one could number, of all nations, tribes, peoples, and tongues, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed with white robes, with palm branches in their hands, and crying out with a loud voice, saying, Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb. And all the angels stood around the throne and the elders and the four living creatures, and they fell on their faces before the throne and worshiped God, saying, Amen. Blessing and glory and wisdom, thanksgiving and honor and power and might be to our God forever and ever. Then one of the elders answered, saying to me, Who are these arrayed in white robes, and where did they come from? And I said to him, Sir, you know. So he said to me, These are the ones who come out of the great tribulation and washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Therefore, they are before the throne of God, and they serve him night and day in his temple. And he who sits on the throne will dwell among them. And they shall neither hunger any more nor thirst any more. The sun shall not strike them nor any heat. For the Lamb who is in the midst of the throne will shepherd them and lead them in living fountains of waters, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. Now, with these verses, a more accurate determination of the identity of the previous multitude can be made. The 144,000, according to my best estimate about it, and you know, you can't be absolutely certain about many of these aspects of this book and these prophetic matters, I believe that we now see with what we just read in the last part of the chapter, that the 144,000 are Jews from the tribes of Israel who have come to follow Jesus as the Messiah, while the multitude in verses 9 and following are distinguished from that being from every tribe, every people, every tongue or language group, thus furthering the idea of Gentile believers now coming into the picture of and being in the covenant. And it's evident from verse 14. Look at verse 14 again. These are the ones who came out of the great tribulation and washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Now, that, I believe, is a pretty evident indication that these people are martyrs, that they have or will become martyrs and suffer during the impending great tribulation. And this also indicates that what has happened or is about to happen in Jerusalem would be extended in some measure in terms of the persecution of Christians across the vast stretches of the Roman Empire, which itself encompassed many tongues and peoples and tribes referred to in verse 14. Now, within the larger confines of metropolitan Jerusalem, many thousands of Jewish followers of Jesus will have suffered either persecution or martyrdom. But that number will soon extend across the empire as persecution of non-Jewish believers begins to grow. And their white robes symbolize their priestly standing before God and their holiness as martyrs for the faith. Now, the words, look back up at verse 10 in chapter 7, verse 10. And crying out with a loud voice, saying, Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb. Now, this is another one of these areas where, because our minds are not thinking like first century Christians living in the Roman Empire, this sort of goes by us without a whole lot of significance. At the time, it was tremendously important. It was that kind of statement could get you into a lot of trouble. Anybody have an idea why? Why would that statement in verse 10, that salutation, that praise of God, get you in trouble in that time? Exactly. Precisely. Thank you, John. Well, you will be awarded your PhD right after the class. Excellent. These words are a direct challenge to the federal authority of the Caesars. In the empire, it was the emperor who sat on the throne. And he was given all kinds of glory and all sorts of accolades, including, as I have had occasion to remark, several of the Caesars were variously referred to as the Son of God, as this name of Caesar being that name by which men are to be saved. All those terms were applied to several of the Caesars in that era, in that time. And so Christians who refuse to give such homage to a man, reserving it for the true God alone, they would be martyred, and martyred by the thousands. Now, that then is what leads us up to the opening of the seventh seal. Again, this is something that sort of doesn't affect us in the way that we might find it so affecting us if we had been reading this 300 or 400 years ago, or even in the time in which it was written. You know, we've got to have so much visual stimulation now that these words don't strike us in quite the same way that it would have somebody in ancient times, because their versions of a kaleidoscope laser light show is what you find in these words. And you would be literally on the edge of your seat because of the way this is unfolding. You've got all this death and destruction and the riders on the horses. And then you've got this interlude, these two visions that come up, and we're just about ready to break the seventh seal. Now, you're going to have to hang on just a little bit longer. Well, actually not, because I think some of the handouts I'm going to give you now may go into a little bit of that. First of all, I want to give you something just for your own interest. We've been inundated quite a bit lately with all of the talk about the tsunami that happened in Southeast Asia. And that event has not gone unnoticed by our dispensational prophecy expert friends, people like Hal Lindsey and Jack Van Impe, with the lovely Rexella, and people like that. And so people who have this idea that when earthquakes are referred to in the New Testament prophetic writings, that it must be talking about what happened 3 weeks ago, they do so out of a position of absolute ignorance about the history of these kind of events in the world. Now, you can see from this list, which I believe AD 532 is the first evidence that we have that these sorts of catastrophes were being recorded. There may have been many others, and there were many others prior to this, but in terms of what we know from verifiable historical recording of facts and events, just look at this. These are the results of earthquakes and tsunamis that have happened following them, beginning in 532 right up to 1908. But you see, the prophecy experts today want us to believe that because of the prevalence of these things in our time, then we now are living in the last days. The rapture's right around the corner. But you see, the argument could have just easily been made in 532 or 1290 or 1662 or whenever else it was. And you begin to understand the foolhardiness and the absurdity of taking these kind of things and say, okay, well, this is it. It becomes meaningless. And you have to be continually revising and hoping and praying that the people don't remember what you said 3 years ago when you said that was going to be the big shot. All right, well, that's just for your own, you can keep that in your wallet or your purse and whip it out at work and destroy your dispensational friends with your great knowledge. Now, does anybody need this sheet that correlates these sections that we're studying in Revelation with Matthew, Luke, and Mark? Anybody need the Olivet Discourse correlation? Okay. Now, let me pass out this. Now, I've got, I think there are 40 of these, and that should be enough for everybody to have one. I discovered a long-hidden resource that I had that may be of some use to you in getting a better conceptual framework after I've just lamented the fact that we are so visual. You know, here I am passing out these kind of visual aids, but that just shows I'm a sympathetic teacher trying to reach my audience and all that kind of good stuff. Vic Lockman is the author of this cartoon booklet. Actually, it's a commentary on Revelation written with cartoons. And for those of you who are into copyright issues, I do have his permission to do this, to copy this and hand this out to you. Unfortunately, the edition of this book that I have, if you'll look on the back of this page, you'll see the numbers 5 and 6. The edition of the book that I have is missing a page. So we go from the opening of the seals and jump to the fifth and sixth seals, and that's pretty much it as far as chapter 6 is concerned. But this is a review of chapter 6, and I want you to notice on the front page where you've got the book and the scroll, the opening of the seals. Obviously, one cannot unroll and read a scroll until its seals are broken. What we have here is a preview of the contents of the scroll, is similar in function to the blurbs on the jacket of a modern book. The breaking of the seals give John's readers an image-rich view of the impending AD 70 fall of Jerusalem. And then he mentions the fifth and the sixth seals. Now, let me hand out number 2 here. If there are any of these left over at the end of class, if somebody would bring them forward so I can keep them for anybody who may need them for next time. Now, this is sort of a recapitulation of what I said last week, referring to the imagery of heavenly bodies being used as symbols of religious and spiritual and political upheaval. He says here on the page, it says heavenly havoc. In this passage, John draws upon the Old Testament imagery so familiar to his readers, but strange to the thinking of modern men. And he gives you several examples of how this kind of language is used. In Isaiah 34, 3-4, and the heaven departed as a scroll when it is rolled together, uses like language as the prophecy of Idumea's fall in Isaiah 34, 3-4. Now, on the next page, he goes into chapter 7, which we have just covered. And you can see he gives you some of the mathematics with the 144,000. Notice what he says about the seal. A seal shows ownership and protection by God. In Deuteronomy 6, the law of God was to be placed on the forehead to indicate that God's people think and act in terms of obedience to God's word. Not so unbelievers. They are autonomous, sealed with the mark of self-serving humanism. Christians living in and about Jerusalem were protectively sealed by God from the judgments of the seven trumpets, which must shortly come to pass. These came out of the great tribulation, the fall of Jerusalem, and drank of the living waters of salvation. Okay. I'll try to have some of these for as we progress through the rest of the study that may be of some help to you. Let me just stop and see if anybody has any questions at this point.